Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that cuts through the noise to bring you the clearest, most impactful insights from the world's most trusted sources. I'm Jamie Murdoch.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse.
Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into The Economist for the week of August 16th to the 22nd, 2025.
Yeah, looking forward to this.
Our mission. Well, it's to unpack the most vital nuggets of knowledge, the surprising facts, and the critical aha moments from this really rich collection of global perspectives. We want to give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed.
Exactly. And it's not just about what's happening, but really digging into why it matters, you know, seeing how all these different pieces fit together in the bigger picture.
We've got an incredible range of topics today. We're talking geopolitics, major economic shifts, even some fascinating social trends and cultural observations. Should be good.
Absolutely. Synthesizing all this diverse information is always the goal, trying to distill these complex global narratives into clear, actionable understanding for you. It's a challenge, but definitely an exciting one. Let's jump in.
All right, let's unpack this. The global chessboard, it certainly feels more active than ever, doesn't it?
It really does.
And, well, as often seems to be the case, a lot of the pieces seem to be moving around one particular player, President Trump. So let's start with America's posture towards China. That relationship defines so much right now.
Right. And what's striking here, I think, is how the military and economic strategies are just so deeply intertwined. It reflects this multifaceted approach to what they see as threats and a very clear shift in strategic thinking in Washington.
The sources really dive into this. We've got America's new plan to fight a war with China and defense in the Pacific, which argues America and its Asian allies need to spend more to deter China.
Yeah.
It feels like the U.S. is fundamentally rethinking its military footprint in the Pacific. What's the core shift here?
That's right. You know, the old model, these large centralized bases, that's being seriously challenged.
Yeah.
The new strategy detailed in these articles, it involves restoring World War II air bases. They specifically mentioned Tinian and Guam, but transforming them. They're talking about dispersed, smaller places instead of these massive, vulnerable targets.
So spread things out, make it harder to hit.
Exactly. The goal is clear. Make it much harder for China to effectively strike American assets in the region.
That immediately makes me think about aircraft carriers. The articles describe these huge vessels as, well, increasingly susceptible to China's long-range carrier killer missiles. They mentioned the DF-26B with a range over 2,000 nautical miles. That sounds like a genuine revolution in naval warfare, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
A total game changer. Historically, carriers were symbols of just unmatched power projection.
Right.
Now, with missiles like the DF-26B, their very presence becomes a massive liability. It's forcing the U.S. to completely rethink its entire Pacific strategy.
So it's moving from dominate the seas with big ships to... what?
To something more like survive and strike from many hidden points. It's a fundamental redefinition of deterrence.
And how does that play out on the ground? Or I guess on the airbase?
Well, it means the U.S. is focusing much more on passive defenses. Things like hardened aircraft shelters made of concrete, even portable pop-up shelters. There's also this concept called flushing the force, basically getting planes airborne before a missile strike can hit.
But how effective is that in practice?
Well, that's the question.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting detail in the sources. They point out that despite this focus, during a recent ACE exercise that's Agile Combat Employment, testing these dispersed strategies, two dozen fighter jets were still parked closely together in the open on Guam. Pretty much an easy target.
Hmm. So the strategy is one thing, implementing it consistently is another.
Exactly. It highlights the real practical challenges of putting these new ideas into action.
And beyond the tactical side, what about logistics? Moving fuel, crews, spare parts? That sounds like a massive undertaking, especially if things are dispersed.
It is a huge undertaking. The articles mention relying on things like 3D printing for spare parts and artificial intelligence for logistics management. They're looking at potentially safer routes, maybe via Australia.
Wow.
General Kevin Schneider, head of Pacific Air Forces, is quoted saying, "Logistics and sustainment are absolutely key to generating air power." It really underscores the complexity of modern warfare on this scale.
Yeah, it's not just about the planes, it's about keeping them flying.
Precisely. And coupled with logistics is this emphasis on something called mission command.
Okay, what's that?
It's the ability of units to act without explicit orders based on the commander's overall intent. The U.S. sees this as a real advantage over what they describe as, you know, rigidly controlled Chinese forces.
So more initiative, more adaptability in the field.
That's the idea. crucial if your forces are spread out and potentially cut off from direct communication.
This shift from massive bases to dispersed places, it really does sound like a tactical chessboard in itself. But then there's the political side of the strategy. President Trump is reportedly demanding allies step up their spending.
Yes, big time. He's pushing key Asian allies, Australia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, to raise defense spending significantly. The number mentioned for Taiwan is, frankly, staggering. 10% of its GDP for defense. Australia, Japan, South Korea push towards 3.5%.
10%? Wow, that's huge. How is that going down with the allies?
Well, this is where it gets highly contentious, as you can imagine. It's creating significant strain on these long-standing alliances.
I bet.
The articles note, Australia's Labor government, for example, has a relatively low Dempers budget, despite its own white papers warning about threats from China. The suggestion is they should maybe put off tax cuts or use debt financing.
And Japan.
Japan, with its high national debt, faces really tough decisions. And the Pentagon needs to be careful here. Pushing too hard could backfire. Apparently, Japan actually canceled a meeting because the Pentagon increased its ask from 3% to 3.5%.
That signals some real friction. Are these allies worried about being abandoned by the U.S. or just resentful about being told how to spend their money?
Both, it seems. The sources explicitly mention fears of U.S. abandonment, like potentially gutting the IAQS submarine pact or the nightmare scenario for them of a Trump-Xi deal that leaves them exposed. And yes, there's definite concern about the U.S. dictating sovereign budgetary decisions.
So the implication is this aggressive push for burden sharing while aiming to boost deterrence could actually weaken the alliances themselves.
That's the critical insight, yes. It forces allies to confront their own security contributions in a way they haven't before, maybe creating resentment if American commitment feels, you know, transactional or uncertain.
Yeah.
It fundamentally redefines the terms of partnership in a really volatile region.
Okay, so that's the military chessboard, complex and shifting. But how does the economic front play into this high-stakes game? We've got sources like supply chain, Xi Jinping masters the dark arts of the trade war, and another on China's power over rare earths. Sounds intense.
It is intense. A key takeaway is the continuation of that fragile trade truce. Trump extended it for another 90 days. But beneath that surface, the economic maneuvering is incredibly aggressive.
Like what?
Well, one really notable development. The White House confirmed that NVIDIA and AMD agreed to hand over 15% of their revenues from China chip sales to the U.S. government, just to get export licenses.
15%, just hand it over. That's unprecedented, isn't it? Like a government-mandated cut of private profits simply to do business?
Pretty much, yeah. It's a remarkable arrangement. And on China's side, they're not just sitting back.
No, I wouldn't expect them to be.
The articles highlight Xi Jinping implementing this licensing scheme, covering over 700 goods, manufacturing equipment, critical minerals, you name it. The stated aim is clear. Indigenize their supply chains and use dependency as a deterrent against foreign interference.
So China is consciously weaponizing its economic leverage.
Exactly. And the prime example of this leverage is rare earths.
Right. Critical for so many technologies.
Absolutely. China controls a staggering 69% of rare earth ore, over 90% of the refined minerals, and nearly all rare earth magnet manufacturing. The sources detail how China's restrictions have already caused real shortages and production suspensions for companies like Ford and Suzuki. The immediate pain for global supply chains is undeniable.
But the sources also hint at some unintended consequences for China, don't they? Like these export controls might actually be spurring efforts to find alternatives globally.
Yes, that's a crucial insight. It seems these actions are accelerating diversification. For example, Japan cut its dependence on Chinese rare earths from 90% down to 60% after a dispute back in 2010. It shows this kind of pressure can be counterproductive for the instigator in the long run.
So others are trying to reduce their dependency now.
Definitely. The Pentagon, for instance, has taken a stake in MKE Materials, a miner in California. And there are apparently 22 new mining projects expected globally by 2030. Plus, recycling is emerging as a significant solution.
Recycling rare earths, how does that work?
Well, companies like CareMag in France are planning to produce, I think it was 2,000 tons a year from recycled magnets. And Cyclic Materials in Canada and the U.S. is aiming for 500 tons a year, even recovering them from things like e-bikes.
Interesting. So this diversification suggests China's long-term dominance might be eroding, or at least facing a serious challenge.
It seems that way. So if we connect this back, it looks like Trump's approach is maybe more about short-term wins, getting that cut for Uncle Sam, right?
Yeah, that NVIDIA deal.
While China seems to be playing a much longer game, using its economic power as a strategic weapon. But even that has limits, as we're seeing with this push for alternatives and recycling.
So the China squeeze, as the article puts it, might actually backfire long term.
It could. It causes enormous reputational damage, the article says. And it prompts Brussels, Tokyo, Washington, everyone to actively seek alternative supply chains. That ultimately weakens China's long-term leverage.
It's this complex interplay between economic and geopolitical power. China's short-term leverage is huge, no doubt, but its actions are kind of inadvertently accelerating global diversification.
Exactly. It's creating a more resilient, maybe less dependent global supply chain in the long run. A classic case of an attempted chokehold leading to resilience and innovation elsewhere.
It's a fascinating look at how presidential power is being asserted, both internationally and economically. Let's shift gears now to Trump's domestic actions and leadership style. The sources paint a very specific picture here, too. We've got why Donald Trump is wrong to take over the D.C. police, and Trump wants to command bosses like she does. He's failing.
Right. And the striking point here is how the president is trying to assert control, both locally in D.C. and over major businesses. He's using methods that, well, in some ways resemble authoritarian tactics, but apparently with vastly different results.
The federalization of the D.C. police is a prime example. The sources say Trump deployed the National Guard and took federal control of the police, citing crime and homelessness. That sounds pretty drastic.
It is. And quite unprecedented. It's apparently the first time a president has used the 1973 District of Columbia Home Rule Act for this specific purpose.
What's really striking is the justification. The article says violent crime in D.C. actually fell by 35% last year to a 30-year low. That directly contradicts the stated reason.
Indeed, which raises questions about the real motive. And the legal and practical constraints on doing this elsewhere are significant.
How so?
Well, the order for D.C. only lasts 30 days. To replicate this in other states, he likely need to invoke the Insurrection Act last used in 92. Hugely controversial. D.C.'s unique status as a territory gives the president more direct control than he has over states.
And how does the military feel about this?
Generally not keen. Army officials usually dislike getting involved in civilian law enforcement. The training, the rules of engagement, they're just very different. It creates an internal friction.
So it seems less like a blueprint for a widespread federalization and more like a targeted, maybe symbolic assertion of power in a unique place like D.C.
That seems a fair assessment. But then there's this comparison the articles make to Xi Jinping's style of commanding bosses. The sources sound quite critical of Trump's effectiveness here. How exactly are they comparing the two?
They seem to argue that Trump's approach, like the shakedown of NVIDIA for that 15% cut, or publicly calling for CEOs to resign it, just falls short compared to how a state-driven system operates.
Right. They contrast it unfavorably with Xi Jinping's more effective authoritarian control over Chinese businesses, citing examples like purging Jack Ma or installing Communist Party cells within companies. Xi's control is described as systematic, deeply embedded, and genuinely effective at steering national economic goals.
And the conclusion is that Trump's approach is largely ineffective, maybe even counterproductive.
Precisely. The sources argue his approach actually surrenders national security strategy for what they call a pittance, that 15% cut from NVIDIA.
Yep.
The article says it's less than the cost of a new nuclear-powered submarine.
Yeah.
It's seen as giving away leverage. His ham-fisted approach is contrasted with, say, China's strategic dumping of cheap products like solar panels or EVs to gain market share and achieve systemic goals.
So the implication is?
Well, the implication is that while some might be relieved, Trump only dabbles in state capitalism. His chaotic, inconsistent approach means America Inc. will not thrive amid chaos. It lacks the coherence and predictability businesses need to really plan and invest long term.
It's a really interesting perspective on presidential power domestically and economically. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of Trump and other world leaders, that relationship with Vladimir Putin, it continues to be a huge talking point, doesn't it? Especially regarding Ukraine and now, surprisingly, a peace deal in the South Caucasus.
Yeah, the dynamic there is always under scrutiny. And one article, The Real Collusion Between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, makes a striking argument. It suggests the real collusion isn't some secret pact, but actually a shared worldview.
A shared worldview? How so?
Where power, not rules, dictates the international order. It's presented as a deeper, more ideological alignment between them.
So it's less about conspiracy and more about a fundamental agreement on how the world works or should work. The article points out Trump consistently blames everyone but Putin for Russia's interference in 2016 for the war in Ukraine. even praising Putin's savvy.
Right. And the article also mentions that grand jury investigation into the Obama administration, apparently based on a misrepresentation of intelligence findings, suggesting it serves as a distraction, one that ultimately benefits Russia by deepening polarization within America and diverting focus from the real strategic challenges Russia poses.
Now, shifting to the actual war in Ukraine, the sources, particularly what Putin wants from Trump in Alaska, describe a pretty grim situation on the ground.
Yes, it sounds very difficult.
Yeah.
Russian forces recently broke Ukraine's defensive line, penetrating over 10 kilometers, cutting a key supply road. A Ukrainian officer is quoted describing it as a depressing situation.
And the Ukrainian soldiers?
Tired, but resolute. The article emphasizes they will always be against a bad peace on the enemy's terms. They absolutely reject any notion of land swaps. It really highlights the immense human cost and that deep, enduring resistance.
And against this backdrop, there's this upcoming Alaska summit between Trump and Putin. What's notable about that?
Well, perhaps most notably, Zelensky and European allies are explicitly excluded from the main talks. That's a big signal.
Wow. So who is setting the agenda?
The potential agenda seems heavily driven by Putin's desires. Things like a ceasefire, sure, but also deeper normalization of diplomatic and business relations, lifting sanctions, even Arctic cooperation.
And the Europeans are just out. The sources mention a remote summit chaired by Germany's Friedrich Merz trying to create a united front. They're insisting a truce must come before negotiations. Ukraine needs a seat at the table. Security guarantees are essential.
Right. Merz apparently claimed Trump largely shares their positions, but clearly anxieties remain high, especially about the possibility of Trump pushing for land swaps over their heads.
What's the long-term implication of sidelining traditional allies like this? It feels like a move towards a more unpredictable, maybe personalized global order.
It certainly suggests a potential erosion of multilateralism, yeah. But perhaps the most surprising geopolitical development reported is in Donald Trump brokers a peace plan in the Caucasus.
Yes, this one really jumped out. Trump apparently brokered a deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan, signing a peace declaration, trade agreements, security agreements.
It's a remarkable story. The centerpiece is Armenia agreeing to open an American-operated transport route right across its territory. It links Azerbaijan to its exclave, Nakhchivan.
And they're calling it the Trump Route for International Peace and Prosperity, or TRIPP. Armenia is leasing the land to America for 99 years. That's a massive commitment.
It is. And the striking point here is the bold geopolitical play it represents. The TRIPP deal significantly diminishes Russia's long-standing influence in the South Caucasus. It's also reportedly angered Iran. Both powers have historically been deeply involved there.
So this could potentially reshape the entire regional balance of power, maybe even lead to normalization between Armenia and Turkey.
That seems to be the hope, or at least the potential. It's a major move.
And were there sweeteners involved to get this deal done?
Oh, yes. A clear transactional element. Azerbaijan apparently got a deal with ExxonMobil. Armenia is said to receive support in AI and semiconductors. Plus, Trump waived some 1992 sanctions on military cooperation with Azerbaijan and announced a strategic partnership.
So a classic Trump deal, perhaps, but are there risks?
Significant risks. The article mentions Azerbaijan's irredentist fantasies, things like calling Armenia West Azerbaijan, which could easily undermine this fragile peace. And then there's a risk of the U.S. just losing interest. Peace in the Caucasus has historically relied on sustained external engagement.
So the long-term success of TPP really hinges on continued American commitment and a genuine shift in regional dynamics.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating example of how diplomacy can be this grand stage, but also a very personal transactional negotiation. It really does reveal a shifting global power balance, maybe at the expense of established alliances and norms.
And it's not just in Europe or the Caucasus where we're seeing these power struggles, right? Other regions are facing their own crises.
That's right. And stepping back, what these situations highlight, whether in West Africa or the Middle East, is the immense fragility of democratic processes, the devastating human cost of prolonged conflict, and these complex internal and external pressures on political groups and militias. They are really battlegrounds for stability.
Let's look at Ivory Coast first. Ivory Coast's president is overstaying his welcome. The 83-year-old president, Alassane Ouattara, announced he's running for a fourth term, despite a two-term constitutional limit.
Yes. He claims a constitutional review effectively reset the clock, allowing him to run again. It's a common and often controversial tactic.
And how has that been received?
Predictably, with significant public reaction. Tens of thousands have protested, demanding free and fair elections, and also the reinstatement of banned opposition candidates like Tijane Tsiam and Laurent Gbagbo.
Has the government responded?
With repression, unfortunately. Arrests of opposition supporters. It's creating a tense situation. Ouattara is still popular with some due to economic recovery and his efforts against jihadists, but this move is seen by many as a big setback for democratic norms in a region already prone to coups.
So there's a real risk of violence ahead of the elections in October.
Yes, similar to what happened in 2020. And the question for the region is whether this sets a dangerous precedent for other leaders looking to bypass term limits.
Then there's the incredibly difficult situation with Hamas, covered in the world's hardest makeover, Hamas. The group is facing intense pressure, both externally and internally.
Immense pressure. Israel is threatening to occupy Gaza. Iran, their main backer, is weakening. And even Qatar and Turkey seem to be losing patience.
And internally, what's the dynamic within Gaza?
The sources highlight a critical shift. Gazan public opinion has reportedly turned on Hamas. People are described as furious, just wanting the nightmare to end. There's even dissent emerging from within Hamas ranks, with some calling for laying down arms.
But negotiations seem stalled.
Completely stalled. The U.S. and Israel haven't accepted the terms proposed in Cairo. Huge issues like disarmament, the role of an international force, and the structure of an interim Palestinian government remain unresolved. And the article notes that Hamas's pragmatism has historical limits.
Yeah.
Meaning the leadership might prioritize its brand recognition as a resistance movement over achieving peace, even if that comes at a great cost to the people they govern. It's a tragic dynamic.
And finally, a related conflict. Lebanon's government apparently taking on a weakened Hezbollah, according to disarming Hezbollah. What happened there?
Well, after an American plan regarding Hezbollah was announced, the group reacted immediately. Members burned images of the prime minister, blocked roads in Beirut.
So direct resistance.
Yes. It just illustrates the deep internal divisions in Lebanon and the sheer difficulty of disarming such a powerful non-state actor. The government is trying to assert control, perhaps sensing Hezbollah is weaker, but it's facing direct, sometimes violent, pushback.
These are truly complex situations, aren't they? Deep historical roots, immediate human impact. The struggle for stability is just ongoing amidst all this fragmentation.
Okay, if global politics feels like a complex puzzle, the world of business and tech is constantly reshaping itself, often at, well, lightning speed. Let's dive into some of the incredible innovations and the economic currents defining our present and future. Yeah, this section really highlights that rapid pace of technological advance and the unpredictable ways it's disrupting established models. But it also reveals these underlying structural challenges in various economies. We're seeing a push for new frontiers, but also this grappling with legacy issues, forcing new kinds of adaptation.
Let's kick off with AI, its transformative potential and challenges. We've got how AI could create the first one-person unicorn, and some letters, one on the waiting time for AI, and another questioning the Genius Act. This idea of solopreneurs, single founders, creating billion-dollar companies using AI sounds almost like science fiction. How realistic is it?
You know, it's an intriguing concept, and the article suggests it's becoming more plausible than ever before. Henrik Wertelin, who co-founded Atos, describes AI as the next big wave after cloud computing. He sees it as democratizing entrepreneurship.
How so?
By allowing people without traditional skills like coding or, say, Photoshop expertise to actually launch businesses. And there's data to back this up, sort of. A Procter & Gamble study showed individuals using generative AI matched the performance of two-person teams without AI. It acts almost like a teammate.
A virtual teammate boosting productivity.
Exactly, which theoretically enables a single person to achieve what might have once required a small team.
But these AI agents, they aren't perfect, right? The sources mention an experiment by Anthropic.
Ah, yes, the vending machine experiment.
Right.
Their Claude Sonnet model, despite its capabilities, actually failed to make money operating a vending machine. It ignored lucrative opportunities, even hallucinated at times.
So still a way to go on the reliability front.
Definitely. And beyond the technical hurdles, there are broader challenges to this solopreneur dream. Business formation in America was actually pretty anemic until the pandemic, partly due to an aging population.
And doesn't AI also make it easier to copy ideas?
That's another crucial point. While AI lowers entry barriers, it also makes imitation easier. That challenges your competitive advantage unless you, as a founder, have truly unique expertise or a genuinely novel idea that AI can't easily replicate.
And then there's the shadow of big tech. It seems the companies providing these AI tools are the usual suspects: Microsoft-backed OpenAI, Amazon, Google-backed Anthropic. How does that affect the dream?
Well, it raises serious questions about dependency and who captures the value. Just like with cloud computing, these tech giants stand to gain a huge share of the value created by these AI-powered startups. It could entrench their power even further.
Kind of like a new form of digital feudalism.
You could see it that way, yeah.
Yeah.
Innovation is enabled, but ultimate control and maybe the lion's share of the profits stay with the platform providers. And adding to the complexity, one letter writer notes that despite all the hype, actual AI adoption is currently at a snail's pace.
Really? Why is that?
They draw an analogy to electricity. Its integration took decades because existing business models weren't suitable, and it required deep structural changes across industries. This suggests AI adoption might follow a longer, more complex curve than some enthusiasts predict, as businesses really figure out how to integrate it properly.
That electricity analogy is powerful. It tempers the hype a bit. Now, what about this genius act for stablecoins? It's getting heavily criticized in one of the letters. For our listeners maybe not deep into crypto, can you briefly explain stablecoins and the issue here?
Sure. Stablecoins are basically digital currencies designed to hold a stable value, usually pegged to a traditional currency like the US dollar. The goal is to combine crypto's speed and efficiency with the stability of regular money.
Okay, sounds useful in theory. What's the problem with the Genius Act?
The criticism is that this act seems to primarily reward the companies issuing the stablecoins rather than protecting the users. Concerns include exposing users to scams, illicit activity, significant operational and cybersecurity risks.
So, not enough consumer protection.
That's the argument. And potentially, it could reduce demand for safer options like government money market funds by offering this competing, less regulated product. The letter draws a really troubling parallel to the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000.
Which did what?
That act weakened oversight in the derivatives market and is seen as a contributing factor to the 2008 financial crisis. The implication is that this Genius Act could amplify financial vulnerabilities in a similar way.
So while AI promises these transformative shifts, it's facing big hurdles, technical, market, regulatory, and it could just end up concentrating more power with big tech, while new regulations in related areas like crypto might introduce unforeseen risks.
It's a very dynamic landscape, yes. Innovation and regulation constantly playing catch up with each other.
Okay, let's switch gears to clean energy. A new wave of clean energy innovation is building. Sounds surprisingly optimistic, especially given some political headwinds. What's driving this optimism?
It is surprising, isn't it? A key insight here seems to be the underlying drivers go beyond just direct subsidies. Despite President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, the OBBB, stripping subsidies for solar and wind, investment in climate tech actually rose a remarkable 60% year-on-year in the first half of 2025.
60%. Wow. So what's fueling that if not subsidies for solar and wind?
It suggests other powerful forces are at play, primarily a long-term shift in market demand and, frankly, strategic interests.
So the OBBB isn't entirely bad news for clean energy. The article implies it actually helps some novel technologies.
Correct. The OBBB strategically extends tax credits for less traditional but maybe more reliable technologies. Things like linear generators, geothermal energy, fuel cells, and new nuclear power.
So bipartisan support for specific, maybe more cutting-edge technologies.
Seems like it. Plus, growing concerns about energy security, reducing dependence on imported oil or even imported solar panels are also fueling this new wave.
And who's investing?
What's fascinating is the significant investment coming from big tech giants. Amazon and Google are investing in small modular nuclear reactors. Oracle signed a deal with Bloom Energy for stationary fuel cells, likely for their data centers.
Ah, so it's not just about going green for them, it's driven by their massive and growing power needs.
Exactly. Their demand is becoming a major driver of innovation and adoption in these specific clean tech areas.
That's a great example of how demand from an unexpected sector can push things forward. But then we swing back to trade dynamics. Japan's car makers are apparently trying to tinker their way out of tariff pain. Trump's 15% tariff on Japanese vehicles is having a big impact.
A huge impact. The article says it cost Toyota alone $3 billion in just 3 months, with a forecast of $10 billion.
Ouch. So what are they doing? Just tinkering.
Pretty much. Car makers like Mazda, Subaru, Nissan are scrambling, pruning costs, shifting sales strategies to try and mitigate the hit. Mazda, for instance, hopes to offset about 75% through these internal adjustments.
But is there a limit to how much tinkering they can do?
The article suggests there is. These tariffs add over $5,000 to the cost of each vehicle imported. And even if they produce more domestically, their costs still rise because so many parts are imported. Global supply chains are just too integrated.
So it highlights the real economic cost of these protectionist policies, ultimately hitting consumers or company profits.
Absolutely. It gets passed on one way or another.
Now, speaking of surprising trade dynamics, this story about a 400-year-old Chinese cough syrup winning over Westerners is amazing. Ninjiam Pei Pakoa sales up almost a third since 2019 to $88 million. Popular on Amazon and TikTok.
It's a fantastic example of cultural exchange meeting modern trends, isn't it? Its popularity seems linked to that whole social media biohacking craze and a growing interest in traditional Chinese medicine practices like gua sha.
So people are experimenting with traditional remedies as part of a wellness trend.
Exactly. A holistic approach.
Uh-huh.
But it's also a stark reminder of tariff vulnerability.
How so?
The syrup is apparently highly susceptible to Trump's proposed 30% levy on Chinese goods. Why? Because many of its key ingredients come from China and apparently can't easily be sourced elsewhere.
So geopolitical tensions could even make your cough syrup more expensive.
Precisely. It shows how these big policy decisions can filter down to affect everyday products and consumers who've adopted these traditional remedies.
It really is a world of surprising connections. Ancient cough syrups finding new markets via TikTok, cutting-edge clean energy driven by data centers. It shows innovation in clean energy is happening, driven by demand and specific policies, even as renewables face headwinds. And meanwhile, tariffs create these huge challenges, forcing adaptation but also raising costs. Okay, let's turn our attention to the financial market. Some really interesting shifts happening there.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this section really highlights how deeply interconnected finance, technology, even culture all are. From, you know, university balance sheets to the emotional palette of great art, economic forces are shaping surprising parts of our world and reflecting our collective mood.
Let's start with Ivy League universities on a debt binge. That sounds wrong, doesn't it? Given their huge endowments?
It does sound counterintuitive. But the sources say despite a tough year for endowments, they lagged the S&P 500, faced costs from cultural war issues. These Ivy League schools issued over $1.7 billion in debt this year.
And they can borrow cheaply.
Yeah, at rates comparable to AAA corporations. It's called a prestige premium.
What does that tell us?
It's really revealing. It shows how comfortable creditors are lending to institutions with such large, stable endowments even after a down year. It's a stark contrast to less famous universities, which face much higher borrowing costs. Academic prestige translates directly into a significant financial advantage in the bond markets.
A clear example of perceived value driving real economic benefits. Okay, then there's the massive question of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. To sell Fannie and Freddie, Trump must answer a seven-tune question. $7 trillion in mortgage debt. They've been in government conservatorship for 17 years now, and Trump's team wants an IPO.
Yes, but it's an incredibly complex challenge. You're essentially talking about privatizing a huge chunk of the U.S. housing market's plumbing.
What are the main hurdles?
Well, first, they face a massive capital shortfall, over $300 billion combined, apparently. That would require an equity issuance far larger than any IPO in history. Then there's the issue of the Treasury's $355 billion liquidation preference from the bailout. Private investors like Bill Ackman want that written down.
But the biggest hurdle?
Probably Trump's pledge to maintain the implicit guarantees of the U.S. government. That promise is what gives Fannie and Freddie their cheap funding. But if the guarantee remains, what problem does privatization actually solve? It might just shift public risk to enable private gain, rather than fundamentally changing the government's role in the mortgage market. It's a huge undertaking with massive implications for housing market stability.
And speaking of housing, America's housing market is shuddering. A slowdown, partly due to the Fed's tight monetary policy, is hitting those pandemic boom towns like Austin and Boise, and also holiday spots like Nantucket.
Yes, those markets that saw huge run-ups seem particularly vulnerable. And Florida specifically saw a 4% price drop. The article attributes that to soaring insurance premiums, driven by climate change impacts, and also expensive new safety rules.
So housing is sensitive to interest rates, obviously, but increasingly to climate change costs, too.
Exactly. Insurance costs are becoming a major factor in affordability. However, the articles also point to something else that's preventing a wider economic slowdown, despite the housing shutter.
What's that?
A colossal build-out of AI infrastructure and data centers by the Magnificent Seven tech companies. Their capital spending now apparently accounts for over 1% of GDP.
Wow, just those seven companies.
Yeah, it's helping to buoy overall growth, reducing the need for broader economic stimulus from elsewhere. It's a surprising, almost hidden driver of the current economy.
Now, on the tech valuation front, we have Palantir might be the most overvalued firm of all time. Market value hit $430 billion, trading at 600 times earnings, 120 times sales.
Yeah, those numbers are eye-watering. One analyst apparently called it the best short idea, comparing its valuation more to a Bitcoin treasury company than a regular software firm.
What does that tell us about the market right now?
Well, it speaks volumes about the speculative froth in parts of the market, particularly around anything AI-related. It suggests a potential disconnect between traditional valuation metrics and sheer investor enthusiasm, maybe driven by FOMO fear of missing out.
Reminiscent of the dot-com bubble.
A little, yeah, where future potential overshadows current profitability. Raises questions about sustainability, for sure. But maybe the most unique economic indicator discussed is in what 630,000 paintings say about the world economy.
This sounds absolutely fascinating. Using human emotional responses and AI to analyze centuries of paintings. What did they find?
What's truly intriguing is the strong correlation they found between economic growth and the emotional content depicted in art. A 4% rise in GDP over 25 years, correlated with a fall in sadness in paintings by 2.2 percentage points, and a rise in contentment by 1.6 points.
Really? And globalization?
Globalization, measured by increased trade, was also associated with happier artwork and an increase in the emotion of awe.
So could art actually serve as a kind of long-term emotional index of society's well-being and economic state across centuries?
That's the provocative question it raises, yes. It suggests art provides this deep, subtle reflection of society's collective mood, offering a really unique lens to view economic history.
It's incredible. From Ivy League debt reflecting prestige, to Palantir's valuation reflecting maybe hype, to the mood of a nation captured in art. These diverse points really show how interconnected finance, tech, and culture are.
Okay, let's pivot now from those macro trends to the micro experiences, the things that define daily life and social shifts. Give us a window into the human condition.
Absolutely. And stepping back, what this section highlights is how these global forces, technology, individual choices, they're constantly reshaping our communities, challenging our understanding of what it means to live in modern society. We're talking about everything from how we travel, how we interact, to how we engage politically, how we confront public health challenges. All right, let's unpack this. From the quirky to the profound, this week's Economist takes us on a really fascinating tour. How societies are changing, from travel habits to confronting deep fears and historical legacies. Let's start with some British societal trends. First up, Asian tourists are returning to Britain, but they look different. 1.1 million visitors from China and India last year recovering post-COVID, but the way they're traveling is different.
Yes, the article highlights a significant shift. These tourists tend to be younger, they travel in smaller groups, they stay longer, and crucially, they're seeking a more authentic British life experience.
Meaning not just London.
Exactly. They're exploring places like York, Castle Howard, going beyond the usual hotspots, and social media platforms like TikTok and Zhaohongshu are making these stranger places, as the article calls them, more accessible and appealing.
Which means the economic benefits of tourism get spread more widely across Britain.
That's the implication, a more distributed benefit.
That's a great example of tech and changing preferences reshaping an industry. But then there's a very concerning public health trend. Vaccinations to prevent cervical cancer have plummeted in Britain. HPV vaccine take-up for year 9 girls is down to 74% from 90% pre-2017, and boys are at 69%.
It's truly alarming. In some areas like Luton and Leicester, the rates are apparently below 50%.
That's shocking. What's causing such a steep decline?
This is really worrying. The articles point to what they call the three C's.
Yeah.
First, confidence eroded by disinformation. Claims from figures like RFK Jr. have had an impact.
Yeah.
Second,
convenience. Simple logistical issues like unsigned consent forms or just school administration challenges create barriers to getting the vaccine delivered effectively.
And the third C.
Complacency. Ironically, because past vaccination success has made cervical cancer less common, parents might worry less, undermining future protection. Plus, cultural beliefs among certain communities like Orthodox Jews or some Pakistani and Polish groups also play a role. It shows how complex public health campaigns are, deeply tied to social factors.
It really does. Now, what about London's iconic black cab drivers? Still want to be a London cabbie? Sounds ominous given Uber and stricter environmental standards. Their numbers have dropped dramatically, right? From 25,000 down to 16,500. Are they a dying breed?
Well, their numbers have certainly fallen, no doubt. But surprisingly, the article says over 1,100 people are currently studying the knowledge.
The knowledge. That's the incredibly difficult test of London streets.
That's the one. 160 years old. Memorizing over 6,000 streets within a 6-mile radius of Charing Cross. It costs about £10,000 and takes 2 to 3 years to pass.
Why are people still doing it? It sounds like a massive investment.
It seems the test acts as a kind of guild protector, a really high barrier to entry, not just about navigation anymore. And interestingly, many of the new recruits are actually former Uber drivers.
Really? Why the switch?
Seeking higher wages and more independence, apparently. Uber often pays as little as £1 per mile, compared to maybe £5.6 for a black cab. So it suggests some pushback against the gig economy's low pay and lack of autonomy, with people seeking more traditional, maybe higher skilled work.
Fascinating. Then there's the surprising political trend. Oh, barricades! Boomers! Older people increasingly dominating street protests. 1 in 5 arrested at a recent Palestine Action protest was in their 70s, including 15 octogenarians.
Yeah, it's a truly fascinating sociological shift. The sources suggest this boomer impunity comes from a practical reality. They often have more time, more money, and frankly, less to lose.
How so?
Being retired means getting arrested usually doesn't impact their jobs or livelihoods in the same way it might for younger people. This creates a situation where older people are becoming, as the article puts it, ballast for radical parties across the political spectrum, from Brexit and Reform UK on the right to the radical left.
So it's not just young activists anymore.
No. And it's a phenomenon that often gets less attention than radicalized youth. But the article highlights it as a serious, maybe overlooked issue, even mentioning examples of elderly extremists committing violent acts. It forces us to reconsider who engages in direct action.
And on the economic side, Britain as a global gaming superpower. That might surprise some people. Revenue bigger than film and music combined. Third largest video game exporter.
It really is a quiet success story for Britain. It acts as an incubator for global blockbusters, think GTAC, Tomb Raider. The industry is highly productive, and it contributes to leveling up, with 4 out of 5 developers based outside London spreading the economic benefit.
And it's not just entertainment.
No, VR developed for gaming is making inroads into fields like medicine and aviation training, showing the broader applications. The main challenges seem to be a shortage of VC funding, leading to British firms getting acquired by foreign giants like Tencent, and the current global slowdown affecting tech generally.
What about AI in gaming?
Interestingly, AI could actually enhance human creativity here. It can boost productivity dramatically, cutting down level building from maybe 90 days to 10, for instance, allowing developers to focus more on the creative aspects.
And finally, a trend that speaks to the datafication of everything. The Fantasy Premier League is changing Britain's favorite sport. 11 million players globally. Driving a nerdier approach to football.
Absolutely. FPL is pushing fans towards data analysis. Concepts like expected goals, or XG, become central to picking your fantasy team. It transforms a subjective game into something far more data-driven for millions of fans.
So it's changing how people watch and talk about the sport, making analytics mainstream.
Exactly. It moves beyond just gut feeling to a deeper analytical understanding of player performance and game dynamics. It's making the nerdy stats part of the everyday fan experience. These diverse trends really show Britain undergoing significant social transformations. Tourism, public health, political activism, digital entertainment. It's all shifting.
These are truly complex situations, aren't they? Deep historical roots, immediate human impact. From the halls of power to the streets, that struggle for stability is just ongoing. Okay, let's wrap up this segment with a look at health, social commentary, and some historical reflections that really broaden our understanding of the human condition.
Yeah, this section really highlights that vast tapestry of human experience, from, you know, grand archaeological discoveries connecting us to ancient lives, right through to modern cultural phenomena shaping how we consume media or challenge social norms. It shows the persistence of the human spirit, creativity, and that ongoing struggle for progress against really deep-seated issues.
We start with growth-loving authoritarians are failing on their own terms. This looks at leaders like Saudi Arabia's MBS or Rwanda's Paul Kagame, who seek economic growth to secure their power, often through big state-led projects or encouraging private investment. Is that strategy actually working for them?
Well, the striking point here is that despite the initial appeal of rapid development, these developmental authoritarians often run into significant flaws that undermine their own goals.
Like what?
The sources detail problems like excessive micromanagement, state-owned companies crowding out private ventures, and even potential manipulation of data to hide underperformance. In many cases, growth still seems heavily reliant on state spending, and foreign private investment isn't slowing in at the rates you'd expect in a true capitalist boom.
So it raises questions about the long-term sustainability and effectiveness of these top-down models for generating real, broad-based prosperity.
Exactly. It challenges the narrative that authoritarianism is somehow more efficient at delivering economic growth.
Then we have a major social commentary piece, Liberal Uruguay and the Right to Die. Uruguay's lower house passed a law to legalize assisted dying, expected to pass the Senate. This would make it the first in Latin America with such a comprehensive law. What makes this so significant there?
It's a profoundly significant step, really reflecting Uruguay's long liberal tradition. Remember, they were among the first in Latin America to legalize divorce, abortion, same-sex marriage.
Right. They have a history of progressive legislation. What's notable about this specific bill?
It's described as notably liberal. There are no time limits imposed, and it's open to people with incurable illnesses causing unbearable suffering, even if they aren't technically terminal. This is crucial for cases like Pablo Canepa, mentioned in the article, who has irreversible brain damage but isn't dying.
And public opinion supports this.
Yes, apparently two-thirds of Uruguayans support it, including a solid majority of Catholics. This shows a notable secularization of the culture, setting Uruguay apart in the region. It's a powerful statement on individual autonomy and dignity.
Shifting back to history, the 4 years when old New York died and a new one was born covers 1986-1989, a period of incredibly high crime, 1,760 murders a year, homelessness, social chaos. But it also saw the debut of figures like Trump, Al Sharpton, Rudy Giuliani, Anthony Fauci. What kind of snapshot does this offer?
It really offers a vivid snapshot of a city in profound transition. It shows how the economic engine fundamentally shifted towards fire finance, insurance, real estate, which would drive growth for decades after.
And beyond the statistics.
Beyond the crime and poverty stats, the book gives this fascinating look at the early actions and defining moments of these now very prominent American figures. It details Trump's wild spending and legal fights back then, Sharpton's rabble-rousing on race, Giuliani's early runs for mayor pushing tough-on-crime rhetoric, and even Fauci's early criticisms during the AIDS epidemic.
Does it connect Fauci's early experience to later events?
The source suggests his experience during the AIDS crisis might have subtly influenced his later approach to public health crises like COVID-19. It paints this really complex picture of a city and its future leaders being forged in a time of intense crisis.
And now for something completely different, but maybe equally insightful. Private chefs are spilling the culinary secrets of the super rich. The rise of figures like Chef Bay on social media revealing client requests like a $2,000 pizza with caviar and gold flakes.
Yeah, this trend, fueled by that whole Hamptons aesthetic and these behind-the-scenes glimpses on social media, it's not just about voyeurism into extreme wealth.
What else is it doing?
It's actually legitimizing private chefing as a serious career path, and even making some of these chefs celebrities in their own right. It showcases a shift in how luxury is consumed and displayed, less about just pure opulence, more about bespoke experiences, and maybe an unspoken competition among the ultra-rich.
A modern example of social media transforming perceptions and careers, even in traditional fields like culinary arts.
Exactly.
Now, speaking of consumption habits, what's your preferred playback speed? 1x, 1.5x, or 2x? This discusses the growing trend, especially among young people, of listening to audiobooks, podcasts, videos at faster speeds. Is this just about efficiency?
It's definitely a sign of a society obsessed with efficiency and information consumption, isn't it? What's fascinating is YouTube claims this collective acceleration saves viewers globally over 900 years per day.
900 years? That's incredible. Does it affect concentration?
Research suggests concentration isn't significantly affected up to about 1.5x speed. However, it raises that important question. Does this trend, while saving time, detract from the art of pacing, tone, and suspension in narration?
So a trade-off between maximizing information intake and experiencing the nuances of storytelling.
Precisely. It fundamentally changes how we engage with content, prioritizing speed, perhaps, over deep immersion.
And we have a re-examination of a classic text. Thought John Proctor is one of the good guys, think again. A Broadway show called John Proctor is the Villain re-examines Arthur Miller's The Crucible through a hashtag MeToo lens, how does that reframe the story?
This is a powerful cultural commentary showing how classic texts get reinterpreted through contemporary social movements.
Yeah.
The play focuses on John Proctor's affair with the 17-year-old Abigail, reframing him not just as a hero against injustice, but as a deeply flawed figure whose abuse of power actually sets the stage for much of the tragedy.
So it explores themes of sexual transgression and accountability.
Exactly. And the perceived lack of justice for abusers in the post-hashtag MeToo era. It reflects current societal anxieties and shows how these classic texts remain relevant for discussing power, consent, and accountability today. It forces us to reconsider familiar heroes and question the narratives we've perhaps accepted too easily.
Next, an incredible archaeological story. The largest dig in a lifetime is underway in Pompeii, uncovering houses, a bathhouse, frescoes, skeletons. A third of Pompeii is still unexcavated. What makes this dig so significant?
This is just a monumental undertaking, promising unprecedented details about daily life in ancient Pompeii. The article highlights how Pompeii has been, frankly, abused and plundered by past generations, making these new untouched discoveries incredibly valuable.
Are there challenges?
Immense logistical challenges. Structures are often supported only by volcanic pumice, creating this Jenga effect that requires extreme care during excavation. But perhaps the most poignant detail mentioned.
What's that?
A child's charcoal handprint found on a wall. A direct connection across two millennia. It's a powerful reminder of the same old humanity, as the article puts it, that lived and loved there before the eruption. A direct bridge to lives long past.
Wow. We also have a piece on a truly remarkable individual. Bombs, dinosaurs, and UFOs. Luis Walter Alvarez's eclectic career. Nobel laureate in physics, designed the Nagasaki bomb, and theorized the dinosaur extinction asteroid impact.
Alvarez is described as the world's foremost scientific detective, a true polymath. His curiosity just knew no bounds. His career also included designing airborne radar systems, investigating JFK's assassination, looking into UFOs, even searching for hidden chambers in the Giza pyramids using cosmic rays.
An incredible breadth of interests.
Absolutely. His story is a testament to an ambitious, brilliant, sometimes difficult mind. He often clashed with others, including Oppenheimer, over scientific and political matters. But he embodies the idea that groundbreaking insights can come from anywhere, from a truly wide-ranging curiosity.
And a topic that might hit close to home for many. Are nightmares bad for your health? The answer, surprisingly, seems to be yes. Frequent nightmares are called a stronger predictor of early death than smoking, obesity, poor diet, or sloth. That's a stark finding.
It is truly concerning and apparently an underexplored area in medicine. The research suggests that accelerated aging, potentially caused by stress hormones released during frequent nightmares, might explain about 40% of the increased risk of premature death.
So nightmares aren't just unpleasant, they could have real physical consequences.
It seems so. They can be both a symptom and a cause of things like depression and anxiety, and are thought to be potentially causal in cardiovascular issues due to the chronic stress they put on the body. It's highlighted as an underexplored field, needing much more attention, moving beyond just seeing them as a psychological quirk.
Finally, a really powerful obituary for Razia Jan, who insisted on educating Afghanistan's girls. She died aged 81, a fearless teacher and campaigner against incredible odds.
Razia Jan founded the Zabuli Education Center back in 2008. It grew to teach 800 girls by 2020, offering a full curriculum, English, Pashto, Persian, math, science, even a tech lab.
And she continued despite the Taliban's return.
Yes. Even though classes stopped beyond sixth grade after the Taliban returned in 2021, she persevered with the younger students. Her secret, the article suggests, was her fearless handling of men, often appealing directly to village elders to protect the school and its mission.
An incredible legacy.
Truly. Her unwavering belief that to plant even a little education in a girl's mind was to sow a seed that would flower is just a testament to her enduring spirit. And that quiet, persistent struggle for progress against such deep-seated issues. A powerful reminder that profound change often starts with one determined individual.
What a journey, from those strategic battles of geopolitics to the intimate battles within ourselves and our communities. It really shows how every corner of our world is just brimming with stories and insights that shape our present and our future. We have covered so much ground today. From, you know, the surprising return of Asian tourists to Britain and the struggles of the HPV vaccine program, to that monumental new dig in Pompeii and the profound impact AI is having on work and life. This deep dive really aimed to give you those essential nuggets of knowledge, hopefully helping you feel truly informed about this complex and fascinating world around us, and maybe, just maybe, sparking a few new curiosities along the way.
Yeah, and stepping back, what really stands out from our deep dive today is that constant interplay between the big global forces and individual experiences, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of these stories, whether it's about tariffs or ancient art or geopolitical maneuvering in the Caucasus, it has implications for how we understand and navigate our world.
Absolutely.
Which raises, I think, an important question for you, our listener. In a world where information is flying at us, sometimes at 2x speed, how do you choose to engage with the challenges and the opportunities we've uncovered today? What will be your next deep dive?
A truly thought-provoking question to leave you with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, stay curious.